what is this movie trying to say about being a woman and being a religious woman? Mm-hmm. Anyway, we're going to get into it. Hey guys, welcome to VoiceOver. I'm Heather Bigley, and on VoiceOver, we talk to people about movies that move them, and we also do bonus material, which is what we're doing today. We're talking to Caroline Johnson about the new and recent Testament of Anne Lee from Searchlight Pictures. It actually dropped in 2025. If you haven't heard about it, it's from writer-director Mona Fastfold, who'd also done The Brutalist from 2023. And we have Amanda Seyfried starring as Anne Lee, who is the founders of this particular Shaker group. It features more than a dozen traditional Shaker hymns reimagined as sort of ecstatic movements with choreography by Cecilia Rolson Hall and original songs and score by Academy Award winner Daniel Bloomberg. It is quite an experience and a sensation. And today we're talking about it not necessarily as a recommendation. We're talking about it as this is representing religious experience, religious women, and religious community. And what does that mean? How did we feel about it sitting through it? What should you know about this representation? So I'm happy to say hello to Caroline. Welcome.
Thank you.
I invited Caroline on as she's the author of The Reinterpretation of the Round Shaker Barn, How Patriarchal Values Change the Doctrine, History, and Architecture of a Religion. She teaches in the Comparative Arts and Letters Department at Brigham Young University and also is the co-director of JKR Gallery in Provo. So she has a little historical experience, but she's also, as an art historian, someone who's paying attention to what religions look like, at least for that project that you did with the Shaker Barn. How did you get, like, why were you drawn to that in the first place? Let's talk about that.
I took an American architecture class in my undergraduate program here at BYU, and we just talked about some Shaker architecture, and one of the most iconic buildings they ever produced was the Roundstone Barn at the Shaker Village in Hancock, Massachusetts. And the whole building is kind of structured in this idea to be run by one person and house over 100 cows. So it really embodies this idea of Shakers being hardworking, being very efficient people, which I think you see as kind of a modern understanding of who the Shakers were, is they were very practical people. And this barn has kind of become this symbol of what practicality really meant for the Shakers. It's striking in its architectural design. It has some really interesting and innovative ideas. It has a really interesting skeletal framework. So it just was visually really engaging to me. And I started researching the barn. I started finding out more about Anne Lee, the history of the Shakers, how it's changed so much over the years. And I was actually able to get a research grant through BYU to fly out and go visit the barn and work with some of the historians on site and talk to their librarians. So it was this really involved project. I got to talk to a lot of people and find out kind of the real nuts and bolts of how this barn functioned and how it was representative, but also in a way contrary to some of the Shaker beliefs. There was no one else there except for me, so it was just quiet and clean and stoic, and I just walked through all these spaces almost by myself. So it was a lot easier, I think, to imagine what these spaces would have been used for, because I wasn't seeing it like in the summer it's a petting zoo and they have a lot of children's programming, right?
Right.
So it was really interesting to see it fully empty and just me talking to a historian, and we're both just so jazzed about this barn, and it was a really amazing experience.
Oh, wow, that's fantastic. I'm so glad that you had that. And you now get to comment on this film. Before we dive into this particular film, I do have this question, and this is for a lot of people, they have very strong feelings. When you watch a film that purports to be a historical summation. Mm-hmm. What are your feelings about historical accuracy?
I think generally speaking, when it comes to a film, you can't really be accurate once you're adding dialogue, because when we're working with people and things and events that happened so long ago, we obviously, that element of dialogue is obviously not going to be accurate.
Right.
So the expectation of having a film with dialogue, I think, already kind of lowers the, for me, the importance of accuracy, because having a cinematic experience, having conversations between characters, that can't necessarily be accurate in terms of what Anne Lee was saying in 1750, right? So it's, I think, in terms of this movie, in terms of movies at large, there are certain events that will like rub me wrong and I'll just be like, that's just so off, like the Napoleon movie with Joaquin Phoenix. Like there were certain things where like it's just so wrong that it was like it's altering the story dramatically. Whereas with other movies, when we just don't know that much, I think creative liberties feel a lot less of a problem to me personally.
Yeah. Yeah. I think for myself, I assume that we have taken several historical personages and combined them into one, often in a historical film. I assume that we've created a character that's going to represent an attitude as opposed to an actual person, right? There was a person who experienced great trauma, and we're going to get versions of that trauma, and we're going to see how that person would have overcome, right? I do feel like there are times when very simply we can just be more accurate, right? We can do that. We should probably hold ourselves to a higher standard. But there comes a point where I just kind of go, well, you know.
For sure. And like film as an art medium in and of itself, we allow the blending of accuracy and interpretation in paintings and in music, you know what I mean? And then all in sculpture and all these other kinds of mediums. So I feel like that same grace can be applied to film as an artistic medium, that we have plenty of portraits that don't actually look like the real person and no one's getting on them for not being accurate, right? So it's kind of the same, I think, attitude.
Yeah, yeah. So that said, let's talk about in this film where what the historical accuracies are. One of the things that's important to know about Anne Lee is that she herself could not read or write. So she was not keeping diaries. She wasn't writing letters. She wasn't a lot of this sort of ephemera that we would be able to turn to and say, well, this is what she thought. It's people on the outside that are going to tell us what Anne Lee was thinking or feeling. So talk to us about what you found in your research.
So from my understanding, from my research, from the historians that I've been reading, is the only or first official kind of history that was ever compiled of Anne Lee was written 30 years after she died. So that was when her history or her life became standardized as Shaker doctrine or kind of as Shaker history. And it was written by the leaders of the Shaker faith who took over after she died. And a major shift that happened after she died is the leaders of the Shaker faith became primarily male, which was obviously a large shift from what we see in this particular movie, where she's introduced to the Shaker faith by a female and her husband, and then she becomes kind of this leader of the Shaker faith, right? So the idea that her personal history was written far after she died and was likely written by men, I think drastically alters what we're reading or what we're understanding of who she was as a person. In terms of accuracy, again, I think for the drama of the story itself, they wanted to push a particular narrative. And the Shakers in our modern day have become known for being a religion that had a female leader that thought she was the physical embodiment of Jesus Christ, right? Or the resurrection of Jesus Christ in a female body. And there's actually no historical documentation that she ever taught that during her life. This is, again, one of those things that was written after she died. It was one of those ideas that kind of became part of Shaker doctrine after she had passed away. We don't have any documentation that she herself was ever referring to herself as Mother Anne Lee, that she was ever claiming that she was this female Christ figure. All those things became attached to her after her death. So I think that it's, again, interesting in this movie because they really drive home this idea that she's mother, right? Everyone's referring to her as mother, not even her name sometimes, just calling her mother. And they never really, she never acknowledges in this particular film that she is the re-embodiment of a female Christ, but you have the believers kind of alluding to that idea. And I think to make a story of Anne Lee, people have an expectation of what the Shakers do, who the Shakers were, and I think they're feeding into that kind of modern interpretation of who the Shakers are.
Yeah. This is the first film that I've seen that's actually, like, on the end title card said, these are our sources, come at me, right? That's how, that's how I felt like it went. And so some of those sources, Anne the Word, Richard Francis from 2000, Shakerism, Its Meaning and Message, Anna White from 1905, Mother Anne Lee by Nardi Reader Campion from 1990. So certainly we have scholars saying, or some of these people aren't necessarily scholars, some of these people are actually acolytes, saying this is what the Shakers believe. But I think this is interesting what you're pointing out to us is that that there's been an evolution in the beliefs of the Shakers. And I think this is something that we see with a lot of religions, right? Whether they started 200 years ago or 50 years ago or 2,000 years ago, there's always this process of standardization. This is what we say. This is our message. And some things get pushed aside and some things get, I don't want to say invented, but, you know, sort of.
Altered, for sure.
Right, yeah. Altered. Yeah.
And so I don't necessarily think it's not what the Shakers believe, because it is what the Shakers believe now. But it's not necessarily reflective of the Shakerism that Ann Lee was preaching. Now, we can't prove that it wasn't, because she didn't write anything down, right? Like, we don't have her sermons. We don't have any solidified doctrine until after she died. So there is a small chance that maybe this was what she was preaching. We just don't have documentation of it. But we can't necessarily say one way or another, because the doctrine was standardized, again, 30, 40 years after she died. That's when we have the first, like, solidified Shaker doctrine, solidified, like, published Shaker beliefs that were accessible to everyone to share what their standardization of beliefs was. And that was far after she died.
Yeah. So what's interesting to me, you talk about how she never probably referred to herself as mother. The film is really going to bring that to the forefront. And I think that's part of what the film is trying to do. The film is trying to present to us, in a time period that we think of as highly patriarchal, politically, socially, legally, we have a woman who comes forth and is arguing for equality in a woman's body, a frail woman's body. I mean, if we use Amanda Seyfried as the incarnation, small woman coming forth and saying, I, as a woman, am having profound religious experiences, and I am now going to become the leader of a group. Mm-hmm. And I'm not going to shy away from being the leader. I'm just going to say, like, let's go to America. That's where I can build this. And we're taking on religious, well, we're taking on female experience and seeing how that becomes part of the religion itself. So female experience, sexual experience, right? Mm-hmm. And one of the things that everyone knows about the Shakers is that Ann Lee said, we need to forego sexual relations, everybody, if we want to reach a higher union with God. Mm-hmm. But we also have the mother experience, mm-hmm. right? And the film is going to very poignantly and very graphically show us that Ann Lee had four children. All of them died before they were a year old. So the idea that the film is going to keep calling her mother, mm-hmm. to me, like, was poignant, reminded us of her grief, right? It really dove into part of why she might evolve, right, at least for her people, in this way. The other experience of being a woman and just walking through the world, right? Being a sister, there's much made of her relationship with her brother. There was a lot in the film that I felt was really interested in examining, what does it mean to be not just a religious person, but what does it mean to be a religious woman mm-hmm. in that specific time? What did you think as you were watching?
I think the parallels of her not being able to be a physical or earthly mother and then turning into this, like, spiritual leader mother figure, I thought was really interesting. I think it was a connection you could very clearly see the film was really trying to drive home, really trying to allow the viewers to make, is that because she wasn't, like, maybe coming to this assumption that because she wasn't able to be a mother here on earth, because she wasn't able to have her own children, that's maybe why she evolved into this, like, mother figure, right? She wasn't just a leader, but she was a mother. She was going to visit people by their bedside. She was really acting as this, like, authority, but very comfortable motherly figure. And I thought that was really interesting. Like, we do know that she lost her four children before the age of one. We do know she had a very terrible relationship with her husband. There's some documentation that he was abusive or they were just really unhappy, which is maybe some of the reasons that she was so pro-celibacy, is because she didn't really have the desire in her own relationship, so it probably wasn't as difficult as previously married couples that were happy together, right, to move to celibacy. But I think her role as a woman in its time was extremely radical, right, to have a female religious leader. I think even today, to some people, it still feels radical to have a woman leading a religion. But that kind of warmth, that womanly nature, even as a leader, I feel like she never loses, which I think is really kind of fascinating, right? As a leader, as a mother to her people, if that's how they refer to her in this film, she does have this really kind of gentle, caring approach to how she wants to serve her people. And I think even just the way that she approaches preaching or the way that she approaches just dealing with everyone, the way she tries to share what she believes is the truth or to do with gospel. She portrays in a very, not necessarily feminine, but a very comfortable, a very warm, motherly, kind of loving way, which I think is, again, very radical at the time, but it's important to recognize who likely how she was preaching, which is deeply in her feminine sense, right?
Right, right. I also think what the movie opened up for me was there are lots of jokes about the Shakers and the fact that they're celibate. And I had this notion coming into the film, or maybe before I saw the trailers, that celibacy meant somehow these people were divorced from their bodily experience. Mm-hmm. But the film is just embracing just the sensual nature of the body. And by sensual, I don't necessarily mean sexual, but I do mean like this touch and this movement, mm-hmm. and the breath, right? These are people who worship through first breath, mm-hmm. right? We see the first time that she attends a Shaker meeting, people around her are breathing in this very emphatic way. Mm-hmm. And she just sinks into it and she starts to do it. And you can see, like, for her, it becomes something, you know, I don't know, revelatory, mm-hmm. right? Like, oh, I can use my body in this way. And then the group starts to dance, mm-hmm. right? And those dances of moving around each other, of sort of being in your own mind and then connecting with the larger group and then coming back into your mm-hmm. own mind, right? Like that this group of religious people is not about casting aside the body, mm-hmm. but it's about using the body in a way that separates it from, you know, the demands of sexuality, I think. I think I'm articulating that in the way I want to.
Yeah, like, no, absolutely. And I think it's really interesting because through all of the scenes of trauma that we're watching with Anne Lee, through all the scenes of worship, you're not just returning to Anne Lee as the character, but you're being reminded of the physical entity of Anne Lee's body. The way her body is moving is changing and how her expressions are changing in this actual very physical sense of how her body reacts differently in certain situations and how her body is looking differently in certain situations, right?
Yeah.
And I think for, again, I don't know if this is necessarily historically accurate. We don't really know what the early Shakers were doing in terms of their intuitive dancing, but with the choreography, particularly in this film, it's incredibly intimate, right? And those early scenes where they're all in these really cramped spaces, they're in these really small rooms, and they're just kind of rolling on top of each other, and they're intertwining their limbs with each other. It's a very intimate and physical activity that they're engaging with together. And again, it's removed of all sexuality because it's almost this spiritual trance that all of them are sharing together. And I think that was something that from the beginning really set the Shakers apart from other early religious groups, is they were so interested in physical expression, right? Whether that be dancing, whether that be yelling or singing, they were constantly engaging in a physical manifestation of what these religious experiences meant to them. So this return back to the body, this return back to a physical manifestation of testimony or of spirituality, I think they did well in the film to keep returning the viewer back to this is a very physical, not just spiritual, but a very physical experience. One of my favorite scenes in the entire film was when they did this interesting kind of cut between her having intercourse with her husband, and then it would cut to her dancing, and then have a quick cut to her like giving birth, and then cut to her dancing, and then cut to her losing her child, and then cut to her dancing, which I feel like is just where she felt freedom in her spiritual experience, and she felt freedom in this intuitive movement as she was expressing her spiritual experiences, where she didn't have that kind of freedom or didn't have that joy when she was engaging with her husband or even with childbirth. It was those two scenes, I mean, they cut so quickly back and forth, you could just see such an obvious discrepancy between how she was feeling engaging in what she considered worldly things and how she was feeling engaging in these spiritual or heavenly things.
Yeah, yeah. I think also the way in which the dance, the religion, and religion here, I mean, there's not a lot of doctrine we get told, mm-hmm. right? I think for a lot of people when we say religion, we're thinking, oh, abstract doctrines, if you will, mm-hmm. Something of the mind. But this is all about being present and experiencing the body and connecting that to this search for God. Mm-hmm. Like one of the songs that she sings, I think she's been imprisoned at this point. She has the song, I Hunger and Thirst for Righteousness, which mm-hmm. is quite lovely. Amanda Seyfried has a beautiful voice, and she's singing that, you know, on the straw pallet and looking up into the light. And so this idea of the religion is physical search for connection.
Yeah, absolutely. And even with the lyrics to their hymns, it's bringing it all back to the body, right? It's you hunger and thirst for righteousness. All of these comparisons are bringing it right back to a physical feeling or a physical manifestation of what that connection to God looks like, which I think the Shakers had a very strong or very kind of important, like felt very important about tying it back to their physical experience and how they could turn their physical experience into something more heavenly.
Yeah.
Which I feel like is unique, right? We don't often talk in a lot of religions about how your physical experience so intently relates to your heavenly or relates to your spiritual experience, which I think was just something very unique that the Shakers held onto.
Yeah. I was reading other reviews of the film and someone was critiquing sort of, well, you know, this wants to say that she came to these religious ideas because she had experienced trauma. And they seem to insinuate that this somehow made her commitment to these ideas less important, mm-hmm. right? Like, if the filmmakers had taken her religion seriously, they would have, you know, I don't know, maybe they would have shown us, like, that she was having this divine communication and it was separate from anything that she had experienced.
Sure.
But I, as a religious person, I feel like, well, of course, all of my religious experience is influenced by mm-hmm. what I've experienced. Mm-hmm. And even, you know, I'm a member of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. There is, I would say, there is so much doctrine, mm-hmm. right, to embrace. And I am drawn to aspects of the doctrine that reflect my experience, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
I know that because I've been through it.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think this is something I actually noticed when I watched the film is every time she has this big revelatory experience, it's after she's been, like, suffering and starving. And I think when I first watched it, I was like, that feels like they're cheaping out the experience because maybe it's, like, a hallucinatory effect or something, right? It felt like it was... she was only having these experiences because she was in such a physically altered state. But I think there's also the sense of it's not necessarily easier, but people turn to God when they're at their lowest more than they do when they're feeling better, right? And Anne Lee's entire life was dedicated towards God. But when she didn't have people to serve and she was in prison and she wasn't eating, like, of course, all of her energy was going towards worship. So this idea that the revelation or these spiritual experiences came to her when she was physically suffering. I think my initial interpretation was a little bit wrong because I don't think that she was necessarily having this, like, hallucinatory effect, which I think the film in some ways makes it look like that. But I think also there is a sense of that's the only place she could put her focus, right? In those moments when she had nothing else, it even just drove her focus even more concentrated towards God and more concentrated towards worship.
Right. I think we as 21st century people don't fully understand the spiritualities of people from 300 years ago.
Absolutely. Right? Like, I don't know what it was like to be a woman in that time, in that body, right, with the lack of medical care, trying to have a child. Like, there's just so many things that I am so thankful I will never be able to relate to, right? But with that, with more suffering comes even more emotion, right? More feeling. She's probably a lot more attached to the feelings in her body, a lot more aware of the feelings in her body than I ever will be because I can take Advil, right, if I have a pain. So, like, I don't have to go through all those things in the same way they had to back then, which, again, just probably heightens all of the emotions, all the feelings that much more.
And also just... she's not the only person having dreams, right?
No,
like, other characters are saying, well, I had a dream and therefore I want to do this thing. And there's room for that, right?
She listens to every single one. Like, when her brother sits her down, she's like, I had this dream. There's, like, big dark cloud coming. You need to be more safe. Like, she sits and listens, right? And when John Hocknull says that he, like, had a vision, she sits and listens to everyone. So this kind of ongoing inspiration is not just from her, but from all of the practicing people in the Shaker faith are all open to having these experiences.
Right.
And a lot of historians have moved towards maybe this understanding that she was one of the many leaders of the Shaker faith, or she was one of a couple kind of heads of the American sect of the Shaker faith as they first move over to America. So I think that also helps us understand maybe this idea that it wasn't just her and everyone else underneath her in this hierarchical sense, but also there were probably multiple leaders. There was maybe this feeling of unity or equality in terms of the leaders and the people, that everyone's having visions, right? Everyone's having beliefs. And it was likely that she wasn't the only leader of the Shaker faith. So right. I think that also kind of embodies that feeling of equality among the people.
Yeah. You mentioned some of the things that moved you. One of the moments that really, or one of the characters that moved me was John Hocknull. He becomes the financial backer of this group, mm-hmm. right? He's just a sincere man, and he's writing the checks. And there's never, at least in the film, there's never this moment where he says, why am I doing this? Or you guys haven't said thank you or any of that. He's just ready to do whatever is needed. And we see his death scene where he says, you know, I was really sick and I was told that I still had some time left. So I decided to use those last weeks working on this project and I got it done. And I, for some reason, was just like, oh, I don't think I've ever been that humble to think, how could I use my last moments doing something for the community that's really needed?
Yeah, absolutely.
I'm like, I'm crying now. Like,
but that idea, like, if you knew you only had like a month left to live, how would you handle it? And seeing this, like you said, very humble, very just sincere disciple being like, I used it to finish this community, build a place for us to worship, right? Build a place for us to be safe. It was right. such a genuine, beautiful moment. And I think he perfectly embodies just this idea of he's just a man of duty, right? He was everywhere he needed to be. He did anything that he needed to do to let these people have, or let him and his people have, a place to be and a place to worship. And there's a big scene before that where he and a couple other men are going to prospect, right, to find the perfect place to put the Shakers. And he's so driven by the Spirit, and he's so driven by this just belief that there is a perfect spot, right? And I think his entire, not his entire life, his later life when we start to meet him, but his later life is just so driven by this duty, not only to the Shakers, but for him to God, right? He is ready to dedicate his entire life knowing that he is going to die. Right. He's ready to dedicate everything he has to God. And that's such a faithful experience that I don't know if I could replicate that, right? Like right. if you had a revelation that you were going to die from the sickness that you currently had, and he's like, hey, I have to work as hard as I can to help my people. That's, it was really a beautiful scene.
Yeah. So let's talk about this. Part of how this film looks has to do, at least in the, I would say, the last third, they're showing us the buildings of the Shakers. Mm-hmm. According to your own research, these people hadn't built anything by the time Ann Lee died, but that's okay. The film is taking those liberties. I did find seeing the buildings really beautiful there. Mm-hmm. I mean, they're very plain, but the craftsmanship, like the wood is just glowing. Mm-hmm. And we get the sense of safety mm-hmm. and peace as they move about caring for, you know. We have images of just people sweeping. Mm-hmm. And for some reason, this for me, like, is like, like these people are now safe. They get to make this a home.
Absolutely. And right. I think it really captured like the day-to-day of what it looked like for the Shakers. It wasn't always this chaotic, right? The beginning is so chaotic. We have Ann Lee, and then we have moving to America, and they're trying to settle things down. And then you have this like set of 20 seconds where it's just showing Shaker boxes, and it's just showing their chairs, and it's showing the inside of their buildings, where it really does kind of show that established nature that they begin to get once they have these big communities, they have places to be, and they start settling into what their day-to-day life looked like. It's not as dramatic or necessarily like cinematic as the dances and the choreography, but it just, this is the life that they settle into. And something I did think was interesting is what we do know about Ann Lee is she was a big proponent of worshiping outside, because mm-hmm. if she wanted no constraints, she wanted movement that just felt so natural. She wanted to make sounds that felt natural. She oftentimes would encourage people to go outside and worship outside because you didn't have any of those physical constraints. But in the movie, we see primarily the worship happening indoors in people's homes. They even show them in My Sweet Perfect Barn. They show them dancing in the barn, which I was just happy to see it on screen. Like, it doesn't matter. But anyways, I think for the sake of the film itself, it's a lot easier to explore interesting choreography when you're in a confined space. Mm. I have been a dancer my whole life. Like, it's, you have to be more creative when you have less space to work with, which I think is a big part of why all of these things happened in buildings instead of being outside, because likely, realistically, they spent a lot more time worshiping outside and doing all their dancing right. outside than they did in these buildings. But it was stunning to watch the choreography when they're in these cramped spaces, when there are so many of them kind of working within each other.
And they, the from what I've read, the filmmakers made a real intent to capture sort of this painterly, mm-hmm. you know, 18th century mm-hmm. use of light, which... I'm not the art historian. I'll let you talk about that. But from what I understand, that comes from Holland. and it looks, it looks gorgeous, right? The skin tones are beautiful mm-hmm. and the use of blues. And they're using this style of, you know, the 18th century Flemish painters.
Yeah, absolutely. It looked so of the time. And also the Shakers themselves focused a lot on light within their buildings oh. because they had this kind of sense of light being a manifestation of the spirit. So there's this one book published by a photographer who went through and took photographs of all of these Shaker buildings when they're empty, but trying to capture the light coming through the window and show how the light against this beautifully polished wood really made these reflective, almost magnificent surfaces. So I loved their use of light because I feel like that was such a Shaker thing to do, right? Yeah. They were so focused on light. They loved the idea of light being infused into their buildings. And I think you could really get the sense of that through the way they use light in this film.
Yeah. After watching this film, what are some big takeaways for you about what this film has to say about the Shakers, about religious women, about religious experience? And do you agree with it?
Big question. I think first and foremost, I love to see smaller parts of history that people don't talk about and that we don't really focus on. And this like blockbuster movie, I guess, if that's what you call them, that's outside of the realm of religious history, right? Sharing the story of Anne Lee.
Yeah.
And obviously we don't know much about her. So especially in her early life, there were a lot of creative liberties, but they're telling her story, which is a story that many people probably don't know, or they're not really thinking about that often.
Right.
I do think it's coming at an interesting time historically. There are two Shakers left that are actually practicing. It's a faith that is probably becoming extinct, which is an interesting time to, I think, introduce a movie. It's not looking back at a faith that once existed, but it's a faith that's almost extinct. But in terms of religious experience in general, I think that what my biggest takeaway was is how a physical experience is so important to and so closely tied to a spiritual experience. Right. I think that was something that even ancient religions, there was a lot more ritual, right? And in the 18th century, we have a lot more physicality just in general, as well as with religiosity. But I think this reminder that a physical sensation or the physical experience is so closely tied to a spiritual experience is just something to remember. I think it's a very special thing that our bodies can be so closely intertwined with what we're feeling and what we're thinking, and leaning into those feelings, right? Incorporating a physical experience into a spiritual experience, I think, is just a very special thing to see on screen, but also a great reminder as a religious practicing person that I need to not try and separate the spirituality and the physicality, but like incorporating those is so special. It right. can be so special.
Thanks, Carolyn, for coming and talking to me. This has been really great. She mentioned there are two people left. From what I know, the last remaining Shaker community is at Sabbath Day Lake, Shaker Village near Poland, Maine. Mm-hmm. And so I'm sorry that we couldn't have those people on the show. But Carolyn did it. Was wonderful. So no sadness there.
It's as close as you're going to get. Yes. I'm so sorry.
Thank you for joining us today. VoiceOver is a production of BYU Radio and is edited by Spencer Boyer.